everybody, and welcome to the Rubberneckin' Podcast. I'm Libby from the media department here at Graceland, and we have a special treat for you today. But before we get to that, I wanted to tell you about some of my favorite things that happened here in Elvis Week in Memphis. If you've tuned in before, you might already know this is my first Elvis Week, and it was amazing. The Cornerstone event, the annual Candlelight Vigil, brought over 31,000 fans from around the globe to pay their respects to the King of Rock and Roll. And for the first time ever, Lisa Marie and her twin girls, Finley and Harper, joined Priscilla at the Candlelight and actually got to light a few candles. So that was really awesome to be a part of. Two huge events shared one night during Elvis Week, and that was the auction and the 9th annual ETA Finals. The auction always surpasses our estimations, and this year was no different, bringing in nearly $1 million. That's right, over $950,000 was bid on Elvis items during Elvis Week, and all of those items were from third-party collectors, and none were from here at Graceland. Now, I'm not playing favorites, but I loved the ETA Finals. I was just blown away by all the talent, and so were my parents, who I got to take with me. We want to congratulate the winner, David Lee, who represented the Ocean City Elvis Festival and received a contract with Legends in Concert, the prize belt, and $20,000. I've always wanted to have my name in one of those massive checks. And as always, check out elvisweek.com for fun videos that captured the whole week. And now for a special treat this week, our very own Sheena Barnett got to interview two of our special guest this year before Elvis Week, and I can't wait to share it with you. So tune in now for Wink and Sandy Martindale.
Well, I was the morning man at WHBQ Radio. I did a show called Clock Watchers, and it was on the air from 5 until 9 every morning. And at night, the most popular DJ in the entire Mid-South, certainly Memphis, was Dewey Phillips. He did a show from 9 to midnight called Red Hot and Blue. And in truth, he was playing at that time, 1954, before rock and roll really started. He was playing rhythm and blues, or black music, black artists for white teenagers, really. And Dewey had something like 60-65% of the audience at night from 9 to midnight. It was incredible. And he had formerly sold records at one of the stores in downtown Memphis. He worked in a record store, and that's where Bill Grumbles, general manager of WHBQ Radio, found him and said, you know what, I think this guy would be good on the radio. And so they put him on the radio, and he was an instantaneous hit. Okay, so Fade to Black can come up on I'm There one night in July 1954, walking some of my friends around from Jackson, Tennessee. They wanted to see WHBQ, because in Jackson, my hometown, everybody listened to WHBQ because we played so much music. And all of a sudden, the switchboard lit up like a Christmas tree, and I thought, what's going on in Dewey Phillips' studio? So I said, guys, wait a second. So I went up the ramp and went into the studio. He had his own studio. They gave him his own studio so he could tear it apart, and he did. But what had happened, Sam Phillips, founder of Sun Records, no relation to Dewey, had walked in and handed him an acetate, not a finished record, but an acetate of a song by a truck-driving singer named Elvis Presley. It was called That's All Right, Mama. A second side, a B-side, as we used to call them in those days, hadn't even been cut yet. He just wanted to check with Dewey whether or not this record would go over big with his audience. And did it ever. He played it over and over and over again, and that's why the switchboard lit up. So Sam happened to have Gladys and Vernon's telephone number. They lived in low-rent housing, Lauderdale Courts, out in East Memphis. And he gave it to me, and Dewey said, would you call and see if we can get Elvis down here? Sam didn't know where he was. So I was the one who got on the phone, and Gladys answered the phone. And she, of course, she and Vernon were listening to Dewey's show because they knew he was going to play that record that night. And they knew about the excitement. And I said, where's Elvis? And he said, well, he was so nervous about his record being played, he went to see a double feature. He's at the Suzors over on Decatur Street. So they said, we'll go down and get him. So they got in their truck, and they went down, walked up and down the aisles of the theater, and there was Elvis sitting by himself watching this double feature. And they whispered to him about the excitement. Well, he was thrilled. Needless to say, they got in the truck. They came down on South Main Street to the Chiska. We were on the mezzanine floor of the old Chiska Hotel. And came into Dewey's studio. Dewey sat him down in front of a microphone and started talking to him about this record. And Elvis, many times later, said, I had no idea I was being interviewed on the air. Had I known, I wouldn't have been able to talk because, you know, he was sort of withdrawn and sort of had a quiet personality, to put it mildly, in those days. But that was the first interview with Elvis Presley, and that was the night that Presley Mania was born. It was July 1954, and it truthfully, that recording, that night, and a year later when Blackboard Jungle came out and Rock Around the Clock, Bill Haley, that's where it all started, and it went on from there. And by the end of the decade of the 50s, of course, rock and roll was the thing. And I might say that I am the only living descendant, if you will, that was in the station that night. Everybody else has passed on. But it was a night that's ingrained in my memory for all times, because we all knew that night that something very special was happening. But nobody had any idea that we were watching music literally change that very evening. And that's my story.
And I think what's so amazing is you had both a professional and a personal relationship with Elvis. You interviewed him several times, and then you also were very close friends. So tell me about Elvis, both the star and the friend.
Well, I met him that night in 1954, and he remained a friend until the day he died. I was not one of the Memphis Mafia, so to speak. I was already married and having a couple of kids, you know, so I didn't have time to, you know, fool around with all those guys. But Elvis was always very nice to me, so nice that in 1956, when I was doing a show called Top 10 Dance Party for Coca-Cola on Saturdays for an hour and a half, he was nice enough to come on my show. It was the first, as I am told, it was the first filmed interview that was ever done with Elvis. He was in town right after making his first movie, Love Me Tender. He was here to promote a charitable event at the Overton Park Shell that he was going to be doing. So he wanted to promote that for charity. And, of course, I was thrilled to death to have the man on my show. And I'll never forget, it was one of those rare times that I've never seen in my career since. We had so much security. By now, Elvis, you know, had Heartbreak Hotel and Don't Be Cruel, and, you know, he was just going crazy. And so many policemen outside, everybody who was off on Saturday, meaning the people in the station, all the sales personnel, all the secretaries, all the bosses, Bill Grumbles, John Cleghorn, who ran the station. Everybody came down, and the control room was packed with people from the station who wanted to see this guy named Elvis Presley, because, as I said, by now, he was just, his popularity was through the roof. And so he did that for me, and it was about a 25-minute interview. I remember I had cue cards plastered all over the walls because I had so many questions I wanted to ask him in 1956, and I was afraid I would forget. I remember asking him, I remember saying, you know, Elvis, when you were going to Humes High School, did you have any idea that any of this would ever happen? He broke in and he said, Wink, I didn't expect to get out of Humes High School, to tell you the truth. But it was one of those, again, one of those rare moments, and I still have that interview to this day. And, you know, I saw him on occasion in Los Angeles from time to time, not often. But he did me another favor in 1959 when I went from Memphis to L.A. to start my career out there. And I was doing a dance party show, starting a new one, just like I was doing in Memphis. And he was in Germany. He was in the Army then. And he was nice enough to do a phone interview with me on the first show to help me kick off the program. And I still have that interview. So, you know, I just feel like I was blessed to have had the opportunity to know this man who not only was a terrific human being, but a man who changed music for all time.
And definitely helped your career, too. I mean,
someone absolutely.
A good friend on and off screen.
Absolutely. It didn't hurt me at all, the fact that, especially when I got to L.A. and everybody, you know, Elvis Presley, ooh, wow. You know, it helped kick off my career out there.
Yeah. And one thing that I love, you were mentioning what a wonderful person he was. I think something that's very special that you did a couple of years ago was that was Elvis to me. And talking about the
yes.
man you knew. So speak a little bit about that and what... What made you want to say that?
Well, right after he passed in 1977 and all the books came out knocking Elvis, it really got under my skin because I knew the man well enough to know that he was so above all of this fol-de-rol that people were saying about him, even some of his so-called friends in these books, to sell books. And so I decided that I would sit down and just write on paper in a narrative form what Elvis meant to me personally and point out the good features of Elvis and all the good that he brought not only to the record industry but to entertainment in general. And so I wrote That Was Elvis to Me, and I went into a studio with an orchestra and a choral group, and we recorded it and put it out on a record, and it's still available to this day. George Klein plays it from time to time on his show, and every time he does, we get orders for it. But it was just a positive feeling from me about Elvis, and I'm so glad I did it, and the response has always been terrific. When Sandy and I were here to cut Elvis's birthday cake a year ago, January, when would that be? 2014? Yeah. Because I don't know when a person will be watching this. But we got to talk to the fans, and I spoke to them, and Sandy spoke to them, and then we signed autographs, and I got to do That Was Elvis to Me live to them, and the response was just terrific.
And I think that's probably something very special for you too, is to for the fans to appreciate the man that you knew as a friend and that you really cared about.
Yeah, and it's so nice because even today, as I do this interview this afternoon, Sandy and I are going to guest with George on his show on Sirius Satellite. And it's always nice to relive some of the fun memories that we had with Elvis, especially Sandy, my wife, went with Elvis off and on for 6 years. And of course I won. But we've been married almost, 40 years, so I got lucky. I married up. Well, you know, as a kid, I always wanted to be on the radio. I wanted to play records and do the news, sports, and all of that. So I always knew what I wanted to do with my life and my career. It was never any question. So I did live up to that. I got on the radio in Jackson, Tennessee, and I played those records. And I went on to Memphis, and I got my dream job, Clock Watchers at WHBQ Radio. And I was playing music by people who were popular in the early 1950s. Eddie Fisher, Joe Stafford, Perry Como, K-Star, people like that. And then all of a sudden, this night in July of 1954, everything seemed to change. I was playing what I call vanilla music in the morning, and at night, Dewey Phillips was getting to play all this black music for the white kids. And then when Elvis hit, it changed my life considerably in that I was now able to play what eventually became, in the next year or so, rock and roll. So in that regard, it did change me as a personality, because it changed the course of the kind of music I was playing on the radio. Lives were literally changed by the King of Rock and Roll, and it was a totally different environment in the world of popular music when Elvis hit. And so that's a long answer to your question: how he influenced me. I hopefully answered that for you.
Well, is there anything else, any other memories you'd like to share, or anything else that I didn't ask, maybe?
No, it's just, I might wrap up by simply saying that of all the days that I've spent in the business, and it's been well over 60 years that I've been doing what I've enjoyed doing since I was right out of high school at the age of 17, the fondest and best and most beloved memory of all my memories, and I've had some good ones, were those encapsulated in the career and around the career of Elvis Presley. Nice man, good man. Like Dick Clark said, there will never be another Elvis. There was only one, there'll never be another. And I feel blessed and honored and privileged to have known him and to be there at the beginning. Okay, Sandy, you're next.
I should get y'all together too. Y'all are so good together. I can just hear you in here just bickering back.
yeah, yeah.
We can do that.
Okay.
But we'll focus on you for now and your story, because your story is so unique. Sweet story.
Oh, thank you. My dad had a nightclub in Los Angeles. It was called The Crossbow. And our band was Lance LeGault, who was in the Army with Elvis and knew Elvis. And when Elvis got finished doing G.I. Blues and he came to California, that's where he would go for his recreation. He'd go to my dad's club every Thursday night because his friend was in the band, and Red West was our bouncer. So he would go upstairs. We had a balcony area and a stairway where he could go up there and be in private and watch the people dancing on the dance floor and have a little dance floor upstairs and enjoy himself and be part of it without, you know, people bothering him. So he called. He saw my picture in my dad's office, and he called me at home and said, "Hi, you know, I'd like to meet you." And I said, it was a school night, and my mom said, "I'm not driving you up to the club. It's 10 o'clock at night." And I said, "No, I'm sorry, I can't come." And he said his name was Elvis Presley. And I thought, that's a funny name, Elvis Presley. I really didn't, you know, I was 14, so I really wasn't aware. But then I became very aware. And so then the same thing happened the following week. He came in again and called again. And I said, "No, I'm sorry, you know, my mom." And he said, "Well, ask your mom if she'll bring you up next Thursday, because I'll be here next Thursday." And I said, "Okay." Because in the meantime, my dad came home and said, "He's such a gentleman. He's so good looking." And so I couldn't wait to go. Anyway, so the next week, my mother drove me up to the club, and I had on a little cute dress with my hair in a ponytail. And he had a date with a gorgeous actress. And he sat there, and he held my hand, and he kissed me on the cheek. I just sat there and stared at him because he was gorgeous. And so that was it, and I went home. And then he called and said, you know, he wanted to date me. He asked my mom. And my mom said, "I don't care if you're King Farouk. My daughter's only 14. She can't, you know." And he said, "Well, Mrs. Farah, you can come on the dates." So that's when he was at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel. And my mother came on the first. It was 1960. I met him April the 1st, 1960. And my mother came on the first three dates. And we would sit. We'd have pizza. We would watch television. We would dance. He'd kiss me goodnight, and I'd go home. And that continued for quite some time. And then my mom said, "Okay, well, as long as you take a girlfriend with you." So I had a lot of lucky girlfriends, because as long as I took a girlfriend with me, then I was okay. And then finally, my mother, he had an understanding with my mom, and he promised her he'd be a gentleman and he'd take very good care of me. And he did. And he was a wonderful part of my growing up.
It seems like he just was a very sweet boyfriend. It seems like you guys had a ton of fun together.
Oh, we had so much fun. He loved to dance, and we would dance for hours. And we had this routine we did to Glenn Campbell's "Turn Around, Look at Me." And it was like an adagio thing. And there's someone standing behind you. "Turn around, look at me." And then I'd turn this way. And then when I turned, he'd turn the other way. And so we were never facing each other until the very end of the song, and then we'd kiss. We'd just turn around and kiss each other. And it was... He loved doing that, and he loved to twist. We'd do the Soupy Sail Shuffle. He loved, I mean, all these fun dances. We just had a wonderful time. In fact, one night we were there, and it was 3:30 a.m., and my mother called and said, "Where's my daughter?" And he said, "Oh, we're having so much fun. We're dancing, Mrs. Fair. I'm just having the best time. And don't worry, she's in good hands, and I'll have her home soon." And that's... You know, we had wonderful times like that.
And, you know, the parents approving of your boyfriend is very important. So did your parents approve?
They did. They did. They approved because he did. He was a gentleman, and he did take good care of me. And so they felt safe. And I would rather go out on a date with him once a month or twice a month than, you know, date. So I didn't date schoolboys, because... Who wanted to date somebody? Once I met him, there was nobody in school that could compare with him. So I just waited for my calls from Elvis.
That is so fun. And then in addition to that, you were in a couple of the movies. You were able to dance in the movies too.
Yes.
Tell me about that, and sort of seeing him in a very professional manner too, being on the set of a film.
It's funny in itself. Viva Las Vegas. I was 17, and you're supposed to be 18 in order to dance in the movies, but my dancing instructor at the time was David Winters, and he was also Anne Margaret's dance teacher. So in class, he said, you know, we're going to do auditions for Viva Las Vegas. And he knew that I dated Elvis. So I didn't tell Elvis because I didn't, you know, I wanted to surprise him. And I went on the dance audition, and I got it because I had the best dance teacher. And there I was, and oh my gosh. So we did on What I Say, the number What I Say, it's Elvis and I are like back to back. There's Ann Margaret, Elvis, and me, and I have no idea what the guy's name was I was dancing with. I couldn't tell you. But we had fun then. We would play, and he would like, during a take, if the take wasn't going well and he knew they were going to bump it anyway, then he'd turn around and he'd like bump me in the butt. And then the director would go, cut. And Ann Margaret, we had to stop tape several times for Ann because Elvis liked orange Nesbitt's pop and he drank a lot of that. So during lunch break, Annie had orange Nesbitt's pop. And during What I Say, when she was singing, they said, stop, why is your tongue so orange? Because it like dyed your tongue. And so they had to stop tape and go and wash your tongue off and then come back. And then we proceeded. But yeah, it was an awful lot of fun. I danced in a bunch of the movies, but I learned in Viva Vegas, which was my first one, that I didn't want to be featured. Because if you're in a scene and you're established, then you can't work in the other scenes. And I thought, oh, well, that's not very good. I want to be here as many days as I can. A lot of days I got paid just for having lunch with Elvis. I mean, what a great life for a young girl. So I stayed in the background. So a lot of times in some of the movies like Spin Out and The Trouble with Girls, there I am. Oh, look, quick, and you'll miss me because I'm going by really quickly because I didn't want to get established because that way I could work more days.
That is so cool.
I know. It really
was.
He was
there for so long.
He was so wonderful. I mean, we were there when he opened in Vegas in 69. It was the International Hotel in Las Vegas. Although I wasn't married to Wink yet, so I was there with my family for the opening. But he would always, when my family would be there, he would, you know, everything would be on the house. We'd have front row seats. Emilio, who was the head maitre d' there, who's passed on, was wonderful, and whenever he'd see me, he'd know, and they'd take me right down to the front, and then when Elvis would go and kiss all the girls, I would always get a little kiss, and he would sing certain songs. What's the one you love the most?
Don't Be Cruel?
No, My Era.
Suspicious Minds.
Yeah, he would sing Suspicious Minds to me because it was like me and Priscilla the same time frame.
Is that your favorite Elvis song? Do you have a favorite?
I like the ballads. I like Surrender. I like It's Now or Never. The ones from G.I. Blues. The ones that were during, I relate to my era of knowing him and the ones that I heard while we were going together. So those are kind of more dear to my heart. But there's not a bad Elvis song.
And I wonder too, one thing that's been so cool, I think, is to see the fans' reaction to the sunglasses that you've made.
Because
they've sold out, fans love them. Tell me about how you got the idea for these and how these came about.
Okay, well, I have always had my Wink glasses. This is my husband, and I have these designed, and then I also have, it's in my purse, my Wink watch that has the heart and Wink on it. And when we were going to come back in January last year to do the cake, I thought, wouldn't it be nice to have a pair made and put Elvis on there so it's first love, last love? And I did, and I wore them, and all the Elvis fans were saying, Mrs. Martin, there's two girls called the Nolans twins, Mrs. Martindale, I love your glasses, I want a pair. And I said, no, honey, I can't sell these, you know, because this is Graceland, and that's just not something I can do. But then I thought about it, and Priscilla and I are friends, and we have been friends for years, and she always said to me, Sandy, if you have a good idea, just call me. So I thought, I have a good idea. So I called her, and I said, Priscilla, I have an idea for some sunglasses. So she said, shoot me a picture. So I sent her a picture like that, and she said, Sandy, they're adorable. And I said, but it will say Elvis on both sides. And she said, fantastic. So she kind of red carpeted me through, and I got a call from Danny, and he set it up that I could, you know, start manufacturing and selling the glasses. And like we were talking about the fan letters, I've never created anything where every time somebody bought a pair, they sent me a picture on Facebook, they thanked me, and they said, Mrs. Martindale, thank you for creating something so beautiful and loving and classy that represents our love for Elvis. It's a little nicer than an Elvis potato head. You know, it's just, it's really pretty. So I just happened to have Elvis here with me. This is his signature. When we first started, we only did the block letters, and then one day I said to Lori, because Elton John has a whole collection that is his signature, and I said, you know, it'd be really nice if we could do Elvis's signature. And man, within 10 minutes, she sent me the signature, and then we started doing signature. We have glasses now. We have our beautiful purse. We have watches. We have iPhone cases with the heart and Elvis. So, huh? A business card case. Yeah. So it's really exciting. And they sent me just last month the first picture of Lori has the display. And I went, oh my gosh, I created that. I've never created anything like that in my life. But it all stems from our love of Elvis.
Right. I was going to ask you about this because really, the sunglasses were such a sellout. And then all of these, I mean, it's just.
They're Swarovski crystals, and they're all hand put on, and we stand behind our merchandise. And then it also has a little chain if you want to, you know, wear it like over your shoulder.
Very stylish.
Thank you. But this is my personal one. So my personal one, I have to give equal time to my husband, Winky. So Winky's on one side like my glasses, and Elvis is on the other. My two loves.
Well, to sort of wrap up, tell me a little.
How did he influence me? Well, first of all, he's responsible for my marrying Wink. When he said he was from Tennessee, and I told Elvis this the last time we saw him, because he thought, what a small world it is that Wink and I were married. And he said, I raised Andy in California, and I knew you in Tennessee. And I said, well, Elvis, you're responsible, because when Wink said he was from Tennessee, I thought, he must be a nice guy, because I loved the state, I loved all the guys, I loved everything in the state of Tennessee, because Elvis was such a wonderful part of my life. So I said, well, that's why, you know, I married him. And so Elvis thought that was really cool that he was responsible. In fact, that day he had seen us on a game show called Tattletales. And he said, wow, you know, he just can't believe what a small world it is. So Wink is my husband because, really, I was open, my heart was open because of Elvis. So he was a huge influence in my life in so many ways. I mean, I looked up to him so much that I remember him saying to me once, Sandy, you know, you have an Italian heritage. You got to be careful. You could gain, you know, you can gain weight, because we love to eat. He loved to eat as well. And so I always, you know, was very, that like sunk in. I mean, it was like drilled into my brain. Be careful, Sandy, because you don't want to gain too much weight. So it's little things that he said to me through the years that influenced me forever. And then he also said to me that I was, I relaxed him. Because when I was young and we were dating, I wasn't some actress. I wasn't somebody that he was going to have to perform anything for. I mean, he had to get up at 6 in the morning to be on the set, and he had to get some sleep. So when he dated me, he had a lot of fun. He relaxed, and then he didn't have to do any other performing. He could go to sleep and get up at 6 o'clock and be on the set.
And you mentioned earlier, I guess we'll bring that up too, the diary that you just found. Your diary is from when you dated Elvis.
I found some, and I know I have more. If I ever, my husband's on me all the time because we have this huge public storage thing that I have to get rid of, and I know I have more there, because when I would come home after a date, I would write down things. I remember he said, I remember because I was reading it recently, that we were on at the house at Bellagio, and he had just gotten some new car, and so we went out front to see the car, and Joe and Alan were sitting in the front seat of the car, and Elvis and I were sitting in the back seat, And then we got out of the car, and he had Alan driving around so that I could see the paint job on it because he was so it was so beautiful. And then we were talking about, he said, Sandy, I want you to, you should see my office at Graceland. He said, I have an orange rug. He says, but you have to see it to believe, you know, you have to see it to believe, you know, it's really beautiful. You just have to see it. And then we talked about some other things. And then he said, somebody said something and they said, I can't remember that part, about, he said, Sandy would, some girl was there and she got in a fight with another girl. And so then Elva said something funny and some girl said to me, Sandy, hit him. And I said, oh no, my mother taught me, you just don't do that sort of thing. I would never hit him. And he said, no, Sandy won't hit me. Sandy loves me. He said, but wait a few years, she'll be throwing things at me. But he was just so much fun.
Well, you know, Wink, I didn't ask you earlier. What's your favorite Elvis song?
I have a couple. For years, my favorite was Don't Be Cruel. Just love that song. So simple, you know, short, to the point, less than 2 minutes probably. Just a great, great record and exemplified Elvis's style so well. Good song. But then, when I first heard Suspicious Minds, which was recorded right here in Memphis, that became my favorite, and it is to this day. When it comes on the radio, there's no way that I'll ever turn it off until it's completely over. And that is my current favorite, and it always will be, I think.
Do you guys have a favorite Elvis movie? Do you all watch a lot of Elvis movies?
Do you know the song that I don't like? What is the name of the one, Winky, Fools Rush In? Is that the name of it, Fools Rush In?
Yeah.
Yes, you know why? Because every time he sang that song, that was the last song in the show, and that meant it was over. And that always bugged me.
Well, you mentioned that. I know you guys saw Elvis several times.
No, honey. I can't count that high.
Well, tell me, I mean, for so many fans who didn't get to see him live, what was it like to see him live? I mean, when you guys saw him, I mean.
It was the best. When, you know, as the years went on, and then when he started with the 2001 theme, you'd just get chill bumps the minute he'd walk out on the stage when you'd start hearing that. It was very exciting. And the worst part was when it was over, because you just didn't want it to end. You wanted it to never stop.
Yeah, I think when 2001, when he started using that as his introduction, and when that came on and kept building, I use that example as the opening for my recording of That Was Elvis to Me. It was just a feeling that personally I've never had in watching anybody perform. And I didn't see Elvis nearly as many times as she did. I may have seen him maybe 6 or 8 times. I saw Johnny Mathis, for example. He was a dear friend. I guess I've seen him 30, 40 times. And a few other people. To see Elvis live and in living color and in person was one of those events that you just never forget. And when we, Sandy and I, were here in Memphis for the first rehearsal of the 20th anniversary, the virtual Elvis show, where he was on the screen and they took the best of all of his concerts and he sang, and then there was a live orchestra on stage with live musicians and singers, the Jordanaires, you know.
James Burton.
And that was, I remember we were sitting in the auditorium that afternoon because George Klein and I were going to introduce Elvis that night. So he came for the rehearsal and we sat there and
cried like
just
babies
crying,
for hours.
You know. Not only because we knew that Elvis was not there in person, but because it was just so great. And it was just, I don't know.
They'd put the spotlight, Elvis would be singing, and he'd go like this, play it, James, and with his hand like that, and then the spotlight would go on James Burton, and you just felt like, you're there and it's live.
For all those many, many people around the world, not only in this country, but around the world, who never had the opportunity, for whatever reason, to see Elvis perform live. I mean, everybody couldn't see him. There weren't that many seats and that many concerts. But this is the second best to see the virtual live performance by Elvis. Was absolutely unbelievable.
And we said that very night to everybody that was there. We said, oh my gosh, because it was really just done specially for the fans for the 20th anniversary. And then it was like, no, this has got to go on. This is fabulous.
And I think of all of the concerts that he did, I wasn't there live to see this, but I joined a billion other people around the world in watching the Hawaii Around the World concert. I think that one was the one that showed off Elvis the best in concert. He looked great. He sounded great. They rehearsed everything down to a T. You know, it was just a perfect concert. And like I said, seen by over a billion people around the world. I think of all of his concerts, that was my favorite.
I'm excited about what they're going to do in Las Vegas now. Because the weekend that he passed, that weekend we were supposed to meet some people in Las Vegas. And so we went there and we actually had brunch in that showroom, and that was hard to do in the first place. But we're sitting there, and when we walked out, the casino bosses were all out there. And I said, you should name this the Elvis Presley Showroom. And they said, we can't do that. What about all the other people that appear? I said, but there was only one Elvis. Well, it took them a few years, to realize that, you know, he does deserve to be honored.
Right.
And I think the reason that the fans love him so much, even today, is he was so good. He loved his fans so much. In fact, in my diary, this one night that we were up at the house, and the fans would all come and they'd be outside. In fact, a girl, they called her Little Sandy. Her name is Sandy Stevens. We became friends, and I've known her for years since then. But he would go outside, and he would spend hours talking to the fans, signing autographs. He spent maybe 2 hours out there just talking to everybody, taking pictures with people. He was just so good about his... He really, in his heart, loved his fans. And one night there was this girl, she came in, we were sitting there on the couch in the house, and one of the guys brought her in to meet Elvis, and she, you know, was, her dress was down to here and up to here, and she stood there right in front of us, and she just started shaking and trembling, tears rolling down her face. She says, oh God, Elvis, I can't believe it's you. And he looked up and he said, you know, honey, sometimes I can't believe it's me either. I mean, it was just so cute.
You know, I always like to point out too that people have no, the average public has no idea the amount of money that Elvis gave to charitable organizations. He didn't make a big deal out of it. He just did it. And if somebody ever went back and wrote a book about all of his charitable contributions and how much he gave, it probably would be that thick. He was just a very giving person. But he never liked that to be made public. He didn't want to make a big deal out of it.
In regards to why, you may ask, in regards to why, you know, our relationship ended, first of all, Priscilla dropped dead gorgeous, so she won. But I made a very large mistake in that, innocently, I dated Wayne Newton. My best girlfriend, Brenda Lee, we traveled together, and we were in Las Vegas, and these two young men that had a show in downtown, the Newton brothers, came, and we went and did a publicity shoot with them, and they went horseback riding. And so then when he came to L.A., he called me and invited me to his Donkashane session. So I went to his recording session, and then it was printed in the Society column of Harrison Carroll, Sandy Ferris sitting ringside, Wayne Newton, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then the next night I had a date with Elvis, and he said, who is this Fig Newton person? And I said, oh, well, he's a friend, you know, because I knew from my little mutual friend and some other people that, okay, so tonight Elvis has a date with me, tomorrow night he has a date with Connie Stevens, the next night Anne Margaret. Well, that was okay because he was a young man, and you know what? God bless him. Thank God he did have a little bit of fun because he wasn't here long enough. But what was my point? I forgot my point.
Well, you were talking about the fact that that's the reason that you kind of lost out.
Oh, yeah. That was it. Because of Wayne. Because in my diary, I read again, and I thought, oh, ding, 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 a bell went off. Lance LaGault said to me, when Elvis first started dating me, he said, Sandy, if you're dating Elvis, don't date anybody else, which I really didn't, but it was an innocent happening. And then after that, I did date Wayne for a while. So in Wayne Newton's book, he says something about, well, I ran into Elvis, and he said, we have something in common. And he said, what's that, Sandy? And Wayne says, let's both stop dating her at the same time. It's like a joke. But neither one of them stopped dating me, so I don't know what exactly he was talking about. But anyway, so I think that's probably part of why, because he figured, Sandy's fine, she's having a good life.
And Winky did not seem jealous of Elvis at all.
No, he's not. We cried together. We loved him together. I mean, he's a bond. He's part of our bond.
Listen, I touch her, and she dated Elvis Presley. I know her. I know her pretty well. No, I've never, because I knew Elvis personally too, and you know, I was never one of his inner circle, but I knew him well, and I just, you know, that's never even occurred to me to be jealous, you know. Jealous of what?
Yes, and that's something that when you were asking me, what did I get from, you know, what did I learn from him? Because he dated me and there was all these girls, I learned to not be jealous because he was still calling me and wanting to see me. So that for the rest of my life, that really helped me with all the girls that, you know, are, oh, Wink Martindale. I mean, I can handle it because he's going home with me. So it's okay.
Wonderful. Well, anything else you guys
want to
add? Any other good memories?
Mm. Now, I think that's
about...
Oh,
honey, we got...
How much time
do
you
have? We could probably go on for days.
Yeah. I don't know when you guys are touring.
It's a delight to talk to you, and of course it's always fun to talk about Elvis because he was such a fun person.
And we love to be at Graceland.
Were you guys ever at Graceland when Elvis was here?
I was.
I wasn't. I was never out here at Graceland.
No, but
I was in town, but no. I was never out here when he
was before Graceland. He was at the Audubon House with Elvis's mother.
Yeah.
Do you want to hear that story?
Why not?
Oh, why not?
You guys want to tell it?
Tell it.
Well, George Klein always likes to point out that how much Gladys thought of me. Actually, she became a fan of mine simply because she was such a huge fan of my Top 10 Dance Party. Every Saturday, she and Vernon both, but especially she would set the time aside, I found out, on various occasions, to watch Top 10 Dance Party at 5 o'clock on Saturday. We were on for an hour and a half. She loved to watch the kids dance. And here her son was the biggest thing in show business, and she wanted to watch Top 10 Dance Party. And I had never met her, but I had heard she was a regular viewer, even when Elvis was in town. Elvis would watch Dance Party. But I found out that my sister Jerry, who lived in Jackson at the time, wanted to meet Elvis. She never met Elvis, but Elvis had just bought his mom and dad the home on Audubon Drive, the first home that he bought for them. And I was able to arrange for myself to take Jerry to meet Gladys and Vernon at their home on Audubon Drive. And that was quite an experience because she was so nice and she wanted to just talk about Dance Party and she wanted to know all the details about where we got the kids, who got the kids, you know, how we picked the various high schools, every little, so I knew, you know, after I met her in person, she really was a fan of the show. And I remember we were sitting in the kitchen having coffee, my sis, Jerry, Gladys and me, and we were watching the kids out on the front lawn tearing up the grass. You know, there were just hundreds of kids tearing up their lawn, you know. She didn't seem to care because they wanted to souvenir. But that's what I remember most about the fact that she was such a fan. And the day that Elvis was on the show, she wasn't in the studio. She didn't come down, or the father didn't either. But I later found out that that was a high point for her, was to see her son on the show that she liked so much.
And isn't that also where he met Anita Wood? Because Anita Wood was Wink's hostess.
Yeah, when Susie Bancroft, my original hostess, left Top Ten Dance Party, we were looking for someone new to replace her. And I had known Anita Wood because we were both from Jackson, Tennessee. So I recommended her. She came over for the interview, got the job. And it was on Top Ten Dance Party that Elvis saw Anita and had George Klein, I believe, was call and set up the original date. She turned down the first time, turned him down. She wouldn't go out with him. But then the second time George called, she did go out with him. And, of course, that was the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
I heard a story recently that I didn't know that Patsy Anderson told me in regards to when Ann Margaret had her fall, that Elvis sent a plane for her, had the seats taken out. Do you know that story? Yeah, and Roger attributes that to saving her life. He actually saved, that's one of, you know, the things, the unknown hero things that he did that people don't realize. But when there was people in his life that he cared about them forever.
And we'll be right back after this commercial timeout. It's my broadcast instinct.
Yeah.
That's a good way to end.
Perfectly, doesn't it? Well, I'm done, unless you guys have anything.
We're done and done.
No, next time. We'll come back another time and we'll give you more. I'll read some of more of my diaries.
Wonderful. Thank you, Justin.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.